funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It would be hard to make up a story more symbolic of the American dream than that of Juan Felipe Herrera. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Born to migrant farm workers in California in 1948, he started school as a shy kid who spoke Spanish at home, but imagined for himself a life as some kind of public speaker. The first teacher to compliment him on his beautiful voice rather than scolding him for speaking Spanish helped him find that voice as a writer, performer, and activist. He would go on to earn degrees in social anthropology from UCLA and Stanford before signing on at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in his 40s. Last year, he was named Poet Laureate of the United States, the first Mexican-American to fill that role, for writing that often weaves Spanish into English to elucidate the American experience. Herrera's many books include 187 Reasons Mexicanos Can't Cross the Border, Half of the World in Light, and Notes on the Assemblage. He's in town for an event that I'll be hosting tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas in support of the Aberg Center for Literacy. Juan Felipe, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure and honor. Thank you.
Last month, you were invited to stay in your post for a second year, which is not something that happens to everyone. Is there like a special kind of satisfaction that comes from not being a one-term poet laureate?
Well, you know, the one term was fabulous. You know, it's a lot and it's beautiful. Second term is a surprise and I'm all into it and already getting going. I'm already thinking about what the new projects are going to be. Beyond that, I don't add to that. It's good enough to be here in the present.
You get to define, each poet laureate gets to define what the job means.
You know, that's what's beautiful about this position and about the Library of Congress. You know, sometimes we may think that it's a very distant entity when, in fact, it's really flexible. So I get to come up with whatever projects I dream up. And, of course, it's kind of like a group, also a very collective process. I talk with Rob Casper, who's the director of the Literature Center, Poetry Center, and also the staff, Matt Blakely and Anya Creighton. So we get around and we kick around ideas, but that's true. It's a whole new vista.
Were you tempted at all to just take a year and do nothing but write?
I was very tempted to do that, you know, because that's what I've been doing all my life, is eating up as much time as I can from everything. And it's difficult to do that so that I can write. And that's what I've been doing all my life until this moment where I really give it all to the entire nation, and all my time is for everyone. And I'm in airplanes, you'll see me scrambling to find a few hours to write. That's where you'll see me writing. And at home, it's quite a mess that I've created for myself and my family back there in Fresno. And I'm very thankful to them, because it's like I have, you know, just immense pancake-like piles on various tables that I have no idea what's on them anymore, but there's writing there and there's journals there.
You have five kids?
I have five kids from the mid-30s to the late 40s, and around 13 grandchildren and two great-grandchildren.
Are you the kind of grandfather who reads stories?
I wish I was. You know, everybody lives in different places. And at home, even at home, you know, they all are in their own places now, in their own cities and homes. And they're all, you know, serious about raising their families in their style.
So that's beautifully put. You could have been a diplomat if not poet laureate.
So when they come to the house, I wish I could do that. But, you know, I'm stealing time. You know, I'm trying to catch up. And when I do hang out with my grandchildren, I do, you know, play with them, tell stories. But most of the time they're playing baseball or goofing around the house, chasing, you know, whatever they can chase, and playing drums on the conga that I have there. So story time must feel very odd to them, because they want to bang things and make noises.
Why does poetry need an ambassador more than other art forms?
Why does it need an ambassador more than other art forms? You know, all art forms need an ambassador these days, because the arts are not, you know, given their due in schools and at large. But poetry, well, we're kind of a spoken thing. You know, we're a spoken world and a writerly world, of course, and an expressive world with words. So we're always talking about things. But why it needs it? Perhaps if we could say that, I would say because sometimes the perception we have of what poetry is, it's a word that's kind of immediately shuts a door. It feels like it's such a private and exclusive thing and elitist thing, when in fact it's a very public thing. So maybe that's why we need more ambassadors, is to say, hey, you know, poetry is you. By the way, you know, poetry is who you are. It's creative expression, it's interior reflection, and it's external play with the world, and, you know, conceptualization as well. So an experiment, most of all. So that's who you are. So poetry is who you are, too. But for some reason, I'm here to help out. You know, I'm here to let everybody know that they are poets, and to assist them and to just listen to them, really.
You've done these projects where you invite many, many people to contribute to a poem. Can you talk about how that works?
Well, it works by inviting everyone. You know, right now I have the Casa de Colores, House of Colors website. You are all totally super invited to jump in. It's the idea behind this is to have everyone, in all languages, submit 250 characters worth of your explosive self in terms of your creative imagination and words on a given theme. Of course, you can take that theme anywhere you want. I wanted to open the biggest door possible for everyone to publish their work and to express themselves at the Library of Congress website. Everyone wants to read it. Everyone reads it. Here you have this opportunity, and globally also. That was the concept, is let's open up the doors. Come in, write, express yourself, have everyone read your work, and everyone read their work nationally and globally. That's the impulse. And Casa de Colores, because, you know, it's multilingual, and whatever language you want to write in, submit your words in, you're totally, absolutely invited to do so. And also to have a house, a casita, you know, a little house where you can do this, and a jardín, a garden, where you can see me do a couple of presentations on the divisions or sections of the Library of Congress, and hold up to you on video the original copy of Don Quixote by Cervantes, or show you Woody Guthrie's letters to Alan Lomax, saluting him on having a child, Arlo Guthrie, of course, the great folk singer pioneers, and on the Cordel from Brazil, the handmade chapbook that's hung on clothespins in the marketplaces in Brazil. And you see that, and maybe you can do one of those too. So it's opening doors to the Library of Congress, the materials that are beautiful, and you following through and creating your own materials as well. So all those things.
Can you tell us a little about your parents? I think people tend to have a pretty one-dimensional view of the lives of migrant workers.
You know, you're right about that. Even though people do have many views of it, we don't hear about migrant farm workers and their lives, immigrant lives as well. We don't hear those lives in the general media, as we all know. And I'm glad NPR and this station does this. You know, it's a beautiful life. It's a very difficult life. It's an incredible life, and it's a very humble and also very brave and pioneering life, all those things at once. You know, work that no one else will do. Work that even if someone else wanted to do it, you'd have to probably spend 4 years learning how to do it, just like you would getting a BA in social anthro. Because, you know, what knives do you need to cut grapes? What knife is that? And what do you wear? And what hand do you use? And how much power do you put into your hand to cut those grapes? And what do you do after you cut them? And where do you cut them at? And you know, don't cut yourself, by all means. That's just the grapes. There's all the products that we use, you know, in a hamburger, except the meat and the bread. Everything else is farm worker made and cut and harvested and packed. For me, it was a life of travel, a life of compassionate kindness and compassion, and of hard work. My parents were older. They weren't the young, you know, vibrant, 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds.
How old were they when you were born?
My father was 66.
Wow.
And my mother was in early 40s, probably 41. I think she was 41 years old. So by the time I was hanging out with them and able to walk around and all that, they were even older. And they were before the farm worker movement. And when farm working was absolutely incredibly painful, and there were no laws, no legislation, no protections at all.
They were disposable.
They were disposable, completely disposable, even more so than today, even with all the policies we have in place. So it was, I say kind because, you know, even because it was so brutal, the work was so brutal, and under, you know, zero earning power, maybe what, I don't know, $16 a month. And on a trailer my father made by hand out of wood he found on top of a car he found hauled by an army truck that he bought in El Paso at Fort Bliss at an auction. I'm sure it was an auction. You know, it's like hammer it together, sew it together, embroider it together, paste it together, life. So that in itself, it's kind of funny. It's super creative, and it's also, you know, at the edge of not having anything at all, but having something that you put together with your own hands, life. And it's also a life with a great history. You know, my father didn't start doing this because he discovered it. It was because he was also a hard laborer in Mexico as a child. And this is our story, you know, this is our story, kind of an earth story, a human plus earth story, and seeds and flowers and plants and herbs that you heal your body with and you cure your fevers with, and a whole myriad of chiles that you know how to grind into amazing salsas, and rice and beans and eggs. You have your own little handful of chickens that, you know, that you raise so you can, given their beautiful little lives given to you, make food with. That's a story. It's a story of pioneers. I guess that's what I want to say. Let's use the word pioneers when we use the word migrants, and let's use the word pioneers when we use the word immigrants, because that's exactly what it is. You know, you come to the United States. You're following a family network that's existed for generations. It's not a new world, but it becomes a new world for you. And you're opening new ground under incredible odds. But to give something to your family and to families that you have left behind, perhaps. And all you want is a little piece of land. That's all you want. It's a little piece of land. And then from there, the next generation will add to it. So it's a world of pioneers. I think that's the better way to look at migrants, farm workers, and immigrants.
When we come back, will you read some poetry for us?
I'll read some poetry for sure.
All right. We're speaking this hour with Juan Felipe Herrera, Poet Laureate of the United States. He's in town for an event tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas in support of the Aberg Center for Literacy. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Poet Laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera. He's in town for an event tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas to support the Aberg Center for Literacy. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. But first, Juan Felipe, you're going to read a poem for us.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much once again for having me on the air. This is a poem from 187 Reasons Mexicanos Can't Cross the Border. And it's titled Mexican Differences, Mexican Similarities. I read this because recently someone told me that they read this poem. So I said, oh, you know, I haven't read this poem much at all. You build a fence, we climb the fence. You hammer it up, we rock it down. You draw the line, we erase the line. You reinforce it, we loosen it. You block it, we dig under it. You use night vision, we use huaraches. You use bomb-smelling dogs, we use chorizo-scented cucarachas. You ask, are you an American citizen? We say, yes, way before you. You organize, we unionize. You chew tobacco, we chew cacti. You call on the governor, we call on each other. You speak in English, we speak in between what you speak. You say oyster, we say orale. You say tomato, we say salsa. You say potato, we say papas. You eat lettuce, we irrigate lettuce. You eat grapes, we pick grapes. You decorate Christmas trees, we farm Christmas trees. You eat turkey on Thanksgiving Day, we raise turkeys for Thanksgiving Day. You sit at the table, we serve the table. You dance on the floors, we mop the floors. You sleep in hotel beds, we make the hotel beds. You got the law on your side, we got history on ours. You get the message. This is the message. You build border walls by the minute. Every minute we cross 1,000. We play baseball. You play baseball. We play baseball. You watch Oprah. We watch Oprah. You shop at Costco. We shop at Costco. You burn under the sun. We burn under the sun. You call this place California. We call this place California. You have a family. We have a familia. You watch General Hospital. We watch General Hospital. You speak a little Spanish. We speak a little Spanish. You read the New York Times. We read the New York Times. You grab a cab to George Lopez Show. We grab a cab to a George Lopez Show. You love the egg rolls at the deli. We love the egg rolls at the deli. You listen to New Age music. We listen to New Age music. You got a problem with terrorism. We got a problem with terrorism. You wonder about the president. We wonder about the president. You want more rights? We want more rights. You stroll the Golden Gate? We stroll the Golden Gate. You read Stephen King? We read Stephen King. You climb Half Dome? We climb Half Dome. You lost someone in the war? We lost someone in the war. You download Alicia Keys? We download Alicia Keys. You wonder about the universe? We wonder about the universe. You wheel grandmother to the home? We wheel grandmother to the home. You ride the BART to nowhere, you ride, we ride the BART to nowhere. You can't quite put the finger on our similarities. We can't quite put our finger on our similarities.
That's U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. Mexican similarities, Mexican differences, or Mexican differences, Mexican similarities?
Something like that.
You know, what's so interesting about a work like that is that there are some very keen messages wrapped in a lot of humor and a little bit of resignation and a great deal of pride. And I wonder about humor in particular to make a point that is a deeply felt one. Why use humor?
Why use humor? You know, it's kind of, you can only use it if you have it. You can only use it if you have it. You can only use it if you have it.
Well, you have it. So.
Otherwise, it'd be hard to use it. You know, I wouldn't know what to, you know, how to even do it. You know, it's also paradox. You know, it's also paradox. You know, I'm really talking about our similarities. I'm really talking about that. But I had to begin at the polar and polar points. You know, where we're kind of very, very different. And but I was going after the similarities, and I was going also after the friction in between differences and similarities. And so it's like the only way we can dance is by being on the other side of each other. And I was looking at that and then leaving it open because, you know, what are our similarities? And they're there, but what are they? We have to really go after them because we are used to seeing ourselves as different. We kind of created our differences as well. We are different. But the last 45 years or so, we've kind of been hammering at our differences quite a bit and for many good reasons. And in doing so, we've also kind of hammered at the difficulty of our similarities, at the difficulty at arriving at them because we were so interested in our identities and carving them out because we were so interested in being authentic, which we were, because we were so interested in carving away the stereotypes about ourselves. So one thing that began to happen, and due to many factors, was that we also carved out the difficulty at arriving at our similarities. So I'm pointing at that because it's so true. You know, we go to Costco, whether you have papers or don't have papers, we're at Costco, and everyone's at Costco in a way, and other shopping monsters.
Who doesn't want 28 rolls of paper towels?
And M&Ms. So that's what I'm after. And sometimes I guess it's when we talk about our daily lives, it's actually funny. You know, when we're kind of into ourselves, we're kind of serious. When we're really into ourselves, we're kind of solemn. And we're super into ourselves, we're kind of ceremonial and kind of lethal. But when we're really just hanging out, we're really funny. You know, we carry around little styrofoam cups and we kind of tiptoe into, you know, the expensive parts of the shopping arena. And we look at, you know, fancy stuff and we make interesting faces when we're buying something. I mean, we're kind of really funny people. And we have funny celebrations and funny ways, you know. You have to have certain things at certain holidays. And we're very careful about those things. And we really worry about not having certain items. And that's all funny. It's got to be funny. So we're actually funny, fuzzy creatures, which take each other very seriously, which is odd, you know.
Have you ever thought about how your identity, how you would feel it differently, wear it differently, had your parents been agricultural workers in Mexico and you were born and raised there? How would you feel, you know, your Mexicanness?
You know, I'd probably feel it much more wholly, you know. It would be like all there. It would be all there, even though there's still, you know, class divisions. You can't, you know, the power grid is everywhere. Stratification is everywhere. That's why, you know, it's not a woman card that women play. Women do have a second-class citizenship throughout the world. And you will not find women at the very top of power in any culture. Maybe there's one in a tribal culture where women actually do have a leadership position all the time. And men have, you know, the second. But I do think I would feel more wholly integrated into society growing up in Mexico. You know, I've visited and hung out in various places in Chiapas and rainforest and Huichol country and Nayarit and Mexico City. And, you know, I do feel deeply part of it, but I also feel deeply separate from it. You know, I just thought to myself, Tomás Rivera, the great poet and writer and also educator and first Chicano chancellor, Latino chancellor of the UC system in California. He said, you know, in an interview in a book, Inquiry by Interview by Bruce Novoa back in the 80s, a great book. And he says in that interview, he says, you know, I'm Mexican, yes, and I can, but the only way I can relate to Mexico, he said, as a Chicano is by reading about it. I'm not part of that of Mexican culture. I'm part of the Mexican culture in the United States, and it's very different. And when I read that, I go, oh, you know, that's cold reality. It was like a big, big bucket of cold reality. I go, you know, he's true. He's saying something very real. I can imagine, like I am right now, being wholly part of Mexico growing up there, but we are different, you know. But I look at the similarities. I'm for unity. And the difference is, I gotta jive with them. I gotta move with them. You know, yeah, we're different, for sure. I want to learn about Mexico more, a lot. And I like to groove on being Mexican too. And I like to groove on being Chicano. And I like to groove on being here in the United States and being born in the United States. And I like to have as many cultural connections as possible. It's no longer a world of one culture, one identity. It's no longer that place. We're no longer in the 50s or 60s or even early 70s. We're not there anymore. We're in a kaleidoscope world, in a cosmic world. At the same time, we're also in a world of surveillance and a much more pronounced power grid where the gaps are even wider and deeper than they were 30 years ago.
You've written about people having escaped the violence in Sudan, waiting in Senegal for asylum, hopefully in the United States. Do you speak French?
No.
Okay. I'm wondering if you're in Senegal, what you're listening for in terms of, or if you're in any place where you don't speak the language at all, as a poet, what you listen for in the rhythms of a foreign language?
What I listen for in the rhythms of a foreign language, I just listen, I listen for everything. Tone, rhythm, music, kind of song, the language song, the Chinese language song, the Arabic language percussiveness that's shared in Spanish, as you know. Ojalá, alfombra, ojalata, and more, alhaja.
Algodón,
right? All those beautiful words. I love those words to begin with. I love those words. I just use them in a poem because I love the sound. Mm. I'm a sound poet more than a meaning poet. I'm a image poet more than a description poet. More than I'm not a cold word poet. I'm a kind of a hot word poet.
So what does that mean, hot word poet?
Hot words like chicharrones,
Yeah. It's hard for me to say, but I love it, chicharrones.
Chicharrones or... what's another one? Just the word Dostoevsky, I want to put that word. I want to put his name on a poem. I mean, it's a moving term. It's alive. It's full of neon. Mm. And that's what I mean by hot words, as opposed to yes, or even though that's a beautiful word, or as opposed to tree, even though I love trees. I'd rather go with eucalyptus, Go with eucalyptus.
When you are... writing, are you always, do you have a pencil in your hand and you're writing on paper, or do you sit at a computer?
I sit at a computer quite a bit, and I went through a long, maybe 20-year paper stage and journal stage and bathroom towel stage, because the towel paper, it used to be very granular, mm-hmm. bathroom towel paper. I used to even run into...
in the men's room.
Men's room. I used to run into the men's rooms, in the university or wherever I was, and tear off a big old sheet of paper towel. That's what I meant, paper towel. You literally could sand down a table with it. And I liked it because of all the fiber in it. Mm-hmm. And so I was a paper... I would run, walk miles from the Mission District to Chinatown in San Francisco, back in the late 60s or early 70s, and go to the stationery store in Chinatown because of the beautiful stationery and hand-bound 400-page thin paper, see-through paper almost, a writing paper that the students in Chinatown would go buy. And I would run all the way from the Mission District to get it. So I spent 20 years of paper writing dude, poet guy. And then when the computers came in the mid-80s, I got one of those first ones. What was it? 63K kilobyte,
right.
Mac. So then I went totally into the computer. And I didn't stop. I'm still using Apple products. I started getting more and more into journals, into writing on journals. So I've gone bananas on journal writing. With ink pens, and I'm a pen guy. There's no way out of it. Leaky pens and red color and microns and a Japanese bamboo, giant bamboo, quill pens and Chinese ink and paint and markers. So I dabble in those fields, and that's how I do it. But journals and computer now. So now I use both.
besides the cold word write, what word do you use to describe the process by which you make a poem? Do you say that you discover a poem? Do you construct a poem?
I say I pull out a poem.
From where?
I pull it out of myself, out of everything. I pull it out of everything, you know. I start blank. Sometimes I do have a melody from the radio, or just a melody of a phrase that comes through my head, or a phrase I see on a newspaper. I go, oh man, that's a poem. That's a title for the poem. I got to start with that line. I got to put that as a title. Or people are speaking. I begin to think only as a poet, and I forget to turn that lens off in a way. And listen as a human being, as a fuller human being. And I start hearing titles. I'm always hearing titles when I have conversations because, you know, that's why I said we were all poets, because we speak. We cannot describe the world and describe our life and truly interact and make profound contact with a human being in the world if we're not poets. It cannot be done. So it's a human activity. You know, when we talk about our lives, you know, we start getting into poetry. When we talk to each other and we really want to say something, we're using poetry. And when we break away from feel our lives are dull, and we go, I'm going to break away from this. I got to get out of this fix I'm in, this habit world. So I want to be me. So when we do that, we enter the world of poetry. We break away and leap and go, this is who I really am, and this is what I really want to do. And when we start doing that and being that, we're entering poetry land. So I would say pull it out, pulling out, carving out, jumping in, running into fast, splashy. Those are the words I would use, splashy.
We're speaking this hour with Poet Laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera. He's in town for an event tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas in support of the Aberg Center for Literacy. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can call us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with United States Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. He's in town for an event tonight at the Latino Cultural Center in Dallas in support of the Aberg Center for Literacy. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Lou on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Lou.
Hi, hello. I just wanted to applaud Mr. Juan Herrera. Estoy su paisana. Mr. Herrera.
¿Qué tal, Lu? Mucho gusto, paisana.
Mucho gusto. Es realmente un orgullo poder escuchar una voz latina aquí en Dallas-Fort Worth, and I just wanted to congratulate you on that. But I just had a short comment. You touched on, you know, the diversity and multicultural history of our people in Mexico, and a lot of people. I am a social worker myself. So I come in contact with people who are from different cultures and groups, and, you know, a lot of people fail to understand that our culture is so rich in diversity. We were not only Hispanic, but we're Asian, and, you know, we're indigenous. We have Indian roots. And so you mentioned something about what happens when, or some, I'm not sure, but I heard it earlier throughout your conversation, how what happens when you come in contact with another group from another country? How do you understand them if you don't speak the language? I think we are so fortunate to be a part of the culture that we are, simply because even when we talk, we use our hands, and we observe a lot, and we taste the food, and, you know, we're able to learn so much from people. just by doing those things. So when we come in contact with other groups, we can learn a lot from them just by observing, rather than basing it on theory and on literature. We can just look at a person or a culture and see how they're cooking.
What do you think about that?
I think that's great. You know, we do have to observe, and we do have to listen, and we have to let go. Like Lou was saying, we have to let go and observe and listen and notice that we're really not that different. We may speak a different language, another generation as well, another country, one that's more pronounced in ways that ours is not, our culture is not. And yet we're going to find that we have many, many great connections, deep connections. So she's right.
Do you think of the United States as a multilingual society?
It is a multilingual society. What the thing is that we need to present that more often and more publicly and through the media and then through the schools.
Tell me a little bit about school for you. It was rough in the beginning, and then you found your way.
It was rough in the beginning, you know, because again, it's the mid-50s. I went to first grade in the mid-50s in a small town, Escondido, at that time. And as a farm worker child, my father literally opened the door to his army truck and pointed to the school building, and I said, "That's it, go over there." And that was his life. You know, he was born in the 1800s, late 1800s, so his life was one of just going over there. And at 14 years of age, jumping a train and landing in Denver, Colorado from Mexico and stepping off and going over there and getting a job in that over there place, in a ranch over there. So I used to think that was kind of odd for him to just point to the building over there. But that's what it was. It was, you got to get up out of this truck. You got to walk over there. Open that door over there, find out what that school thing is over there, get into the class over there, and make yourself a student on your own. I'm not going to go with you. You're going to do it by your lonely self. And that was hard. Also, actually, more difficult was being spanked and punished for speaking Spanish in the classroom. The first 20 seconds I was in there, I was already crying.
Surely you weren't the only kid in the class who spoke Spanish, right?
How could I tell? I mean, probably not, right? This is Escondido. And I came from the outside of that city,
yeah,
on a little ranch that my father was taking care of. But you're right. No, I wasn't the only Spanish-speaking child. But I was only trying to figure out what was going on, so I didn't have time to scan around. I had a very thin view, a very thin focused vision. Just I walk over there. There's a teacher over there. Go straight to her and say, "¿Qué voy a hacer? ¿Qué hago? No sé." And boom, I laugh now, but I cried, and it took me a long time to put it together. You know.
Did you speak English before you got there?
No, I didn't speak any English. I mean, I grew up as a campesino boy. And I know there were some words I must have known, you know, like, candy or something, or milk. but no, I didn't know. I didn't know how to speak English or much English. So anyway, that was my first number one encounter. And because it was so harsh, I shut myself down. I said, "Well, I'm not going to speak at all. Forget it. You know, I'm just going to sit here and go with the flow." Which is harder, you know, because then you're not participating and you're not, you know, you're not speaking out. You're not expressing yourself because the expression power has been cut off. So you have to build it. You have to empower yourself again, because I had all that already from my parents in their world and the world from the outside looking in. But once I was in the inside world, which was school, I had to start from scratch. I had to find empowerment. I had to wait till my third grade teacher, because that kind of punishment continued. The 50s were very brutal on those that spoke other languages, especially Spanish and being Mexicano, and black also. And, immigrants in general, I imagine, because I only knew my experience. But I'm sure it was more than me. It wasn't just me. So a third grade, Mrs. Sampson, Mrs. Lelia Sampson, I've told her story many times because it's a story that turned me around. She invited me to sing in front of class. So to be invited to sing is very different to be punished and to shut up. It was the opposite. So then she said, "You have a beautiful voice." And that's something else. That's a new thing also, to be told by your teacher that you have a beautiful voice. And it was like the magic key. She gave me a golden key, which was, "You have a beautiful voice. You have, you is me, to have a you, to have a subject, to have an actual human being, have, to own something, that you have a beautiful, something that is beautiful, that entails beauty, which is an ultimate ideal, a dream. And that beautiful thing is a voice that you have, that you own, which you, as a subject, as a real human being, have achieved." And I couldn't put it all together. And it became my life. And I also give this golden key to everyone I meet. That's why I'm here today. And that's why I said yes to being a poet laureate, because I want to give that golden key to everyone of all colors, all cultures, all classes, all people from all arenas in the United States. I want to tell you that you have a beautiful voice too. And I want you to express your beautiful voice in as many ways as possible, and your own language, and the way you were brought up, and the way you are now. And please do so. Become who you really are and share your voice and give it to others. And this will help us all be who we really are and come together and build a society that's a beautiful society of harmony, unity, and nonviolence.
People who love theater rarely content themselves with reading a script. People who love music are not satisfied by looking at sheet music. Why is it that we think that poetry can be fully felt and experienced when we read it silently?
Because we go into ourselves, you know. It's a mirage that the poetry is outside of us. It's a mirage. That mirage has some words in it, of course, like a mirage does. A real mirage, you can actually see it. It's there, you know, it's out there. But it's really you, very deeply inside, you know. It's like a dream. "Oh, yeah, I had a dream." It's like you had it in some little department in your life. No, you didn't have a dream. You were that dream. You were that dream. And you still are. It's a very interior place to be with poetry. But, of course, we cast it out because our voice casts it out. And then others hear this very deeply, this very deep reality that's very soft and tender, and that's very private, and it's full of these things called imagination and play and discovery and expression. And it's not something like a recipe. It's not something we're telling people to do. It's not an exchange of business. It's not a business conference. It's not trafficking items to build something specific. It's like swimming in human consciousness that reveals many sparkling diamond-like beauties and unknowable, almost, secrets that we can perceive and touch for a moment, and if we make an attempt, we can write it and share it.
Do you ever lose a poem that you have working in your head?
Oh, yes, I do, you know. And when I do, I have to just say bye. You know, I want to go grab it, but it's gone. I want to go sit down and see if I can come up with it. Sometimes I can a little bit of it, but when it goes, it goes. You know, you only have it for a split second. Maybe if you really pay attention to it, you'll have it for, maybe 30 minutes, maybe 20, and just maybe a little bit longer. But it's like that, you know. It's like our life. It's fleeting. It really isn't any different than that. But because it's so short of an existence, it's easy to say, I had it for a little while. But life is like that too. Even though you say, my life is longer than a poem idea I had this morning. Okay, yeah, okay, if you put a time clock on it. But it's actually just as fleeting. Look back the last 10 years. Where did they go? Look back the last 20. Where did they go? I swear, they felt like a long time. I swear they had 1,000,000,000,000 things in them. But I swear also that they were just a moment ago. I was bopping down San Francisco with Victor Martinez and Francisco Alarcón. I was going to North Beach to hang out at City Lights or just to bop around and go all the way to the pier. And, you know, municipal pier. But that was actually 1981. So, yes, you can grab the poem. It'll last for a few seconds, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, in the morning maybe. And you'll lose it. And if you lose it, cool. That's the way it was. And say, thank you, little poem fragment. I enjoyed you for a little while.
Did your parents imagine the kind of extraordinary life that you've had for you? Could they conceive it?
Well, I think so. Now that you say it like that, I think they could conceive it because my father had to conceive that life in the United States that he left when he was 14 from Chihuahua. He had to have this big poem in front of him to go after it. And he did, and he found it in Denver, Colorado, and Wyoming, and Cheyenne, and you name any southwestern state, he probably found it there back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And my mother, my mom was kind of a natural poet. She would stand up in the middle of a breakfast or dinner or during the day and lift her arm up like a big rhetorical gesture and recite a poem, you know, the autumn leaves are falling, yellow, red, and gold. And in English, she would say one, or in Spanish. And I would just look at her and in awe. Everything would stop. I just have to look at her. And that would be her one child audience. And and she also blessed me a lot, you know, the way we do. And my mother would always be, you know, bendiciones, giving me bendiciones in the morning, bendiciones during the day, bendiciones in the evening, bendiciones in the morning, you're going off to college now, bendiciones when you come home to visit, bendiciones when you leave, one after the other, after you, her whole life, I'm an only child, her whole life. So I have a whole lifetime of my dear mother's life of blessings. And it's those blessings that have made me who I am and have opened the doors for me. People have opened them for me. Teachers have opened them for me. Friends have opened them for me. Great teachers, spiritual guides have opened them for me. Even strangers have opened them for me that I meet on the streets.
I'm going to have to close one for you because we're out of time. Juan Felipe Herrera is Poet Laureate of the United States. Thank you so much, Juan Felipe,
Thank
for
you.
Being with us.
It's a great honor.
Thanks for listening and have a great day.